This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The fourth Wednesday of every month.
Whoa, wait, it just happened again. You guys totally heard that, didn't you? It's like I'm time traveling or something. Anyway, I distinctly remember already hearing that. I feel like I'm going traveling. It's like I'm time traveling or something. Time or something. Hi, I'm Ryan for the KBOO Youth from the KBOO Youth Collective. The theme of the month is time travel. Listen to the KBOO Youth Collective 6 to 7 p.m. on the fourth Wednesday of every month. Hope you're there.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
We'll hear the results of last night's school board meeting to merge several middle schools in North Portland.
The Hanford nuclear site in Washington is still leaking radioactive waste, and Senator Wyden has called for an investigation.
Military contractor KBR files a motion to try to get out of paying damages to wounded Oregon veterans.
I'm Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 26, 2013. I'm Sequoyna Wright.
And I'm Nat Parker. Last year, consumer advocacy groups scored a victory for homeowners facing foreclosure when Senate Bill 1552 established the Foreclosure Avoidance Mediation Program. But bankers have since found a loophole in the program that Economic Fairness Oregon said they're working to close during the legislative session this year. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with their executive director and Angela Martin about the differences between judicial and non-judicial foreclosure and the organization's trip tomorrow to Salem.
What does your organization do?
It's simple. Economic Fairness Oregon works to help Oregonians hold on to more of their hard-earned money by ending the tricks and the traps and the abuses that have become all too commonplace in our financial markets.
And you're planning a trip to the state's capital tomorrow. Can you tell us why?
That's right. Tomorrow, we're going to go to Salem, joined by other advocates, asking lawmakers to close the foreclosure mediation loophole. A year ago, lawmakers passed a very important foreclosure mediation law, saying simply a lender has to sit down with their homeowner face-to-face to have a meeting before initiating a foreclosure. Unfortunately, a week after that law went into effect, a judge in Oregon made it clear to lenders that they could no longer use the out-of-court foreclosure process unless they were willing or able to record all of those assignments. The result was essentially shifting the way Oregon lenders foreclose on homeowners and taking it all to the court. Mediation wasn't linked to judicial foreclosure, so we saw that program never really got up to speed the way it was intended. We're going to fix that this session. Lawmakers took a big step last February when they passed the Oregon Foreclosure Mediation Law. This will be an opportunity to close the door on the judicial loophole that has allowed lenders an easy path for ignoring the mediation law. We need to close that, make sure every homeowner has a chance to meet face-to-face with their lender and get real answers.
What can you tell us about the homeowner?
Tomorrow, we'll be going to Salem with a woman named Marie. Marie and her husband had experience, like many others, they missed a payment, and it was actually an administrative error. They had never missed a payment in their life. They'd paid off many homes in the past. So an administrative error led to a years-long nightmare of late fees, penalty fees, incomplete information, all just trying to stay one step ahead of foreclosure. It took them more than 5 years to come to an ultimate conclusion. They held on to their home, but to this day, Marie is so traumatized, she claims that she can't even deal with bills anymore because she's afraid another minor error is going to result in another five-year nightmare. We talk with people every day who do everything that they're told, send in their paperwork, have conversations with this representative at the mortgage servicer, all to no avail, all to be told that the paperwork was lost and their request was denied without ever being reviewed.
How can people who want to get involved and help or need help, where should they go? What should they do?
Continue to pay attention to this issue. This has been in the headlines for far too long. And as a result, many of us are becoming numb to the conversation around foreclosures and what we need to do to hold banks accountable and get justice for homeowners. Please stick with the conversation because people are still in trouble and we still need accountability. So number one, have a conversation with your lawmaker. Call, email, show up in Salem to let your lawmaker know that you support Senate Bill 558. It's real easy to find out information, and matter of fact, we have it all on our Facebook page. If you look up Economic Fairness Oregon on Facebook, you're going to find the fact sheets, the dates, the hearing room, everything you need to stay involved.
And your website is economicfairnessoregon.org?
That's right.
Angela Martin, Executive Director, thanks for the work that you do.
Thank you.
This is Robin Ryan for KBOO News.
The Oregon Small Business Association is soliciting donations and signatures to try to stop so-called surprise taxes. Their proposal would require that any proposed local laws that result in local tax increases be subject to citizen votes. This would include all municipal ordinances, resolutions, and codes. The Oregon Small Business Association is a registered nonprofit based in Clackamas. Leaders include Jason Williams, co-founder of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon, T.J. Riley, who owns Same Day Auto Service in Clackamas, and Tom Magnus, the CEO of Computerized Entertainment Concepts, a Chuck E. Cheese franchise. The group opposes the sick leave proposal being considered in Portland and all other tax and fee increases. In a mailing, the group called Portland's sick leave proposal, quote, the type of law that will close your favorite local-owned restaurant or cafe.
Voters in Clackamas County are again facing problems brought about by County Clerk Sherry Hall. Wilsonville voters received a voter's pamphlet that had the wrong date for the upcoming special election. The misprint labels the ballot cut off as one day later than the actual deadline on March 12th. County Clerk Sherry Hall attributes the misprint to a proofreading error, despite four people reviewing the document. A correction will be mailed to voters, costing the county about $1,800. This is the fourth notable mishap for the Clackamas County Elections Office in as many years. She oversaw the office during last November's election when a staffer was found to have tampered with ballots, casting votes for a Republican candidate when voters left items empty. Hall was unavailable for further comment.
Portland Public Schools, or PPS, is working through big changes in the Jefferson Cluster that might have been a lot bigger if not for the voices of district parents. KBOO's Don Merrill talked with PPS spokesperson Matt Shelby about changes in the district schools.
I'm just curious to understand exactly what was it that happened last night.
You know, for months we've been in a conversation with not only families and parents at those two schools, but the broader Jefferson Cluster community around options to really balance enrollment across the schools in the cluster. The superintendent's recommendation responded to that. It didn't go nearly as far as some of the options that had been out there and had been vetted publicly proposed. And I think that's what we're hearing today, is that there's a real sense of responsiveness on the part of the community.
Right. I was looking at the schools that have been closed and the schools that have been affected by zoning and attendance problems in some districts versus others. And I'm just curious to know how the decisions to, for instance, the decision to move Access Academy out of Sabin School, how that decision was made since I thought that the Access Academy was supposed to be a program to help gifted students in the underperforming part of the Jefferson cluster?
Well, the Access program is designed to help highly gifted students that are struggling in their neighborhood schools from across the district. So it really is a district-wide program. Where they're currently housed right now at Sabin, they're outgrowing that space, and Sabin is growing as well. So there's not enough room in that building for the students that will be coming back next year. It has more flexibility as far as where we put it. The superintendent hasn't identified a spot yet, but we will in time for the coming school year.
And I guess the same kind of question for the Harriet Tubman Young Women's Leadership Academy that was closed last year. Also, it's getting too small for the students that would attend it next year?
And it was really closed because it got to a point where it just didn't have enough students to, because the money follows kids, it didn't have enough students to garner enough funds to have enough teachers to offer the programs that kids need. And so the decision was made last spring to close that program.
Right. And I was looking at an issue that involved the Alameda Elementary School and Sabin School. And at the time that this was a debate, one of the proposals was to rezone rezone some of Alameda into Sabin. And even though it seemed like it was a good practical solution, some of the folks in the Alameda district were talking more about preserving cultural integrity, and they weren't really talking very much about money. I'm just curious, what happened to that proposal? I mean, that would have helped Sabin, wouldn't it?
It did, and actually what came about of that, a boundary change did result at the end of that process, and actually some of the Alameda boundary was was carved off and sent to Sabin. A small portion was carved off and sent to Irvington. So we did end up relieving some of the stress on Alameda. The decision that was made last night merged two schools that already shared the same neighborhood boundary. So students that were attending Chief Joseph attend Ockley Green for middle grades. Now we're operating that school across two campuses as a shared K-8. So we haven't actually added any additional transportation time for any of those students.
Okay. So then when the superintendent said that one of the issues was keeping facilities open, that's what she was talking about?
That's exactly right. Well, and that was in response to the Woodlawn closure was an option that was laid out as a possibility. We heard loud and clear from the Woodlawn community and other school communities in the cluster that a real desire to maintain their buildings, keep them open, and then work with the district to help grow the enrollment more organically. And that's what this school board decision really responds to.
So what's going to happen now?
So now Chief Joseph and Woodlawn will go through kind of an implement. Well, they'll go through a merger or a consolidation process. And so there's a process now to determine school leadership, to determine exactly the grades that are going to be on each campus, and things like that.
Okay, well, Matt Shelby with Portland Public Schools, thanks for talking to me.
Anytime, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
Governor John Kitzhaber wants to put a repeal of Oregon's death penalty on the ballot in 2014. As he traveled back from the National Governors Association Conference in Washington, D.C., Kitzhaber said that times have changed since Oregonians voted to reinstate the death penalty in 1984. The governor said that courts are applying stricter standards and continuously raising the bar for prosecuting death penalty cases. He added that this approach would lead to rising costs. If referred by lawmakers, the measure will go on the general election ballot in November 2014. Kitzhaber said he regrets not intervening in the two earlier cases, which ended in executions by lethal injection in 1996 and 1997, when he was governor for the first time. Oregon voters repealed the death penalty in 1914. It was then reinstated in 1920, repealed again in 1964, and reinstated in 1984. Oregon has executed 40 people since 1903.
This coming June, the Supreme Court of the United States is expected to issue a ruling on the constitutionality of California's Proposition 8, which restricts marriages in the state of those between a man and a woman. In a move likely to deepen the cracks in the Republican Party, nearly 75 prominent conservatives have submitted an amicus brief to the court in favor of overturning Prop 8. The opinions expressed in the brief fly in the face of House Speaker John Boehner, who has campaigned at great expense to persuade the court to uphold Prop 8. The brief cites bedrock conservative values such as limited government, individual freedom, and stable family units. The Republicans who have signed on to the brief include national and state congressmen, former governors of New Jersey and Massachusetts, and numerous former members of the Bush and Reagan administrations. The debate over Prop 8 has highlighted the divide between socially moderate and socially conservative Republicans, and some strategists worrying about the future stability of the party.
The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today in the case of Maryland versus King on whether police should be allowed to take DNA samples from people who have not been convicted in a crime. The court appeared split on the issue, although a final decision will not be announced until May. Today's case challenged a practice in Maryland state courts of collecting DNA samples from anyone arrested of a felony. Their genetic information is then stored in the national database, CODIS, for the rest of their lives. 27 states now allow for the collection of DNA from arrestees regardless of conviction. Advocates have been vocal on both sides, with victims' rights groups claiming that the DNA database could prevent future crimes by identifying repeat offenders early in their careers. Civil rights groups, however, point out that collecting DNA samples from suspects is a violation of the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search and seizure. The Electronic Frontier Foundation argues that DNA collection laws like Maryland's can also be used to compile data on political activists who are arrested but never convicted of a crime.
18 Republicans crossed the aisle today and voted to end the Senate filibuster blocking a vote on President Obama's nominee for a Pentagon chief. The 61-vote threshold to proceed was met with a vote of 71 to 27, and Chuck Hagel became the first defense secretary in history required to garner 60 votes to win confirmation. Republicans delayed Hagel's nomination vote with a filibuster on February 14th in order to question him further and actively object to his nomination. Democrats have spoken out against Chuck Hagel, and with their majority in the Senate, it seems likely we will win a majority vote there and be appointed as defense secretary later this week.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news at 5:30, followed by special programming. Tune in, turn on, and remember, KBOO celebrates 45 years of radio. Tonight's special welcomes Rob Bailey and Sheila Rubin, who will talk about their early years involved in KBOO programming. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is a slight chance of rain, with a delightful high of a wonderful 52 degrees.
It is 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Any remake of the 1950s movie The Bad Seed should cast Monsanto in the title role. This biotech behemoth has a monopolistic grip on the creation and sale of frankenseeds, the seeds of corn, cotton, soybeans, and other crops that have had genetically modified organisms spliced into their natural DNA structure by corporate lab techs. Why insert risky, inadequately tested GMOs into our food supply? to produce crops that can survive heavier doses of toxic pesticides, specifically pesticides marketed by Monsanto. The corporation gets more profit, we get more pesticides and new man-made health risks. That's enough to make a truly horrific movie about the bad seed, but Monsanto has added to the horror by almost sadistically applying another level of its monopoly power. Having patented the GMO technology, the corporation asserts that when the plants grow in a farmer's field and subsequently produce their own seeds, those second-generation seeds do not belong to the farmer, but are Monsanto's private property. Thus, the seed-saving ethic that has sustained agriculture all around the world for centuries has been decreed illegal to benefit Monsanto. And the profiteering giant prowls the country to find and sue any of its own customers who dare practice the sensible art of seed-saving. The bully has 75 staffers and a $10 million a year budget dedicated to monitoring, investigating, prosecuting, and intimidating small farmers, even if some second-generation GMO seeds cropped up in their fields inadvertently. This is Jim Hightower saying, this is a case of one deep-pocket corporation perverting patent law in order to monopolize the sale of seeds, gouge thousands of farmers, and endanger both human health and the environment. To fight the ongoing horror of this bad seed, go to organicconsumers.org. What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A recent study has found that pesticide use is the leading cause of grassland bird declines in the United States. The study was conducted by Canadian toxicologists. It looked into bird population data for the last two decades, as well as pesticide data from the 1980s and 90s. The researchers found that declines in grassland bird production populations were more likely in states that use a high amount of insecticides, which are toxic to birds. Organizations such as the American Bird Conservatory are working to integrate this information into their strategies, which had previously focused on preserving habitats in the face of urban sprawl and rapid agricultural changes. Bird populations have declined most drastically in the Great Plains and Great Lakes regions. Scientists fear that the continued use of pesticides at current levels, coupled with habitat loss and fragmentation, could result in widespread local extinctions of these birds. While the global pesticide market has shifted toward newer nicotine-based chemicals and away from the chemicals that were popular in the years covered by the study, evidence suggests that the new pesticides are also critically toxic to birds.
Oregon Senator Ron Wyden is calling for an investigation into the leaking underground waste at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. On Friday, Washington Governor Jay Inslee announced that six single-walled underground tanks are leaking radioactive waste. One of the tanks, known as T-111, has a long history of leakage. The department categorized the 530,000-gallon tank as an assumed leaker in 1979. On February 15th, the U.S. Department of Energy, or DOE, announced that T-111 is leaking as much as 300 gallons of radioactive liquid waste every year. Stephen Chu, the outgoing energy secretary, told Governor Inslee on Friday that the department initially missed the other five leaking tanks because DOE staff did not adequately analyze the data. As the new chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, Wyden sent a letter today to the government accountability office asking to investigate what the Energy Department and its contractors knew about the leaks and whether they were reported in a timely manner. For more on the story, KBOO's Rebecca Ney spoke with longtime anti-nuclear activist Lloyd Marbit. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, and I'm speaking with Mr. Charlie Fisher for Environment Oregon. What are the most pressing issues that Environment Oregon wants to get across to U.S. Forest Service?
Yes, absolutely. The very fact that they're proposing to effectively clear-cut old growth is bad enough in this proposal. But this proposal actually is on the edge of Crater Lake National Park, and that's what makes it especially egregious. This, in addition to the miles of road that will be constructed in these roadless areas, is going to threaten wildlife and fish and destroy critical habitat and degrade water quality in rivers and streams. So that's really the main concern that we have.
If the sale for the Bybee Timber Lake sale goes into effect, how will this affect Crater Lake?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, like I said, this is right on the edge of Crater Lake National Park, literally on the edge of it. So, you know, wildlife that lives in this area, they don't know the difference between a national park and a national forest. So to destroy the habitat right outside the national forest is going to invariably affect the ecosystem of the national park itself.
With the sequestration legislation going through this Friday, how will this affect Crater Lake, seeing as though national parks are part of the budget cuts that are going to take place in the sequestration?
That's a good question, and actually that's not something that we're following, but it's definitely something to look into. I know that sequestration does have the potential to cut funding for a lot of national parks and a lot of the funding that is needed to protect these areas. We've collected 10,000 public comments in opposition to the Bybee timber sale from Oregonians across the state that we'll be delivering down in Medford to the National Forest Service tomorrow, which is the day before the public comment period closes. And on the way, I will be stopping in Eugene, starting in Portland, to publicize this and actually show some of the nearly 100 pictures that we've collected from our members of them at Crater Lake. So, you know, this is kids playing at Crater Lake, people jumping into Crater Lake, one of the clearest and purest lakes in the entire world. And after this decision is made, really, you know, what we want to do is create a 500,000-acre wilderness area in and around Crater Lake, which Bybee Timber Sale is actually located within. So this wilderness area would permanently protect lots of forest around Crater Lake National Park that is currently, you know, has the potential to be threatened just like the Bybee Timber Sale area is. And it'll connect several smaller wilderness areas into a 90-mile wilderness corridor that will allow us to permanently protect some of the last old-growth forests that we have in the state.
And where will all your advocates meet at in Portland?
Yeah, actually, it'll be right outside of our office at 9 a.m. Down in Woodstock, and that's 7036 Southeast 52nd Avenue.
Okay. I have been speaking with Charlie Fisher for Environment Oregon. And that was myself speaking with Charlie Fisher of Environment Oregon, who will help organize for tomorrow's event. Now we go to the actual story with Rebecca Ney on the anti-nuclear activist Lloyd Marbit.
Lloyd, what's your response to the announcements last week that there are 6 underground tanks leaking at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation?
As a part of the cleanup effort that's been going on there, they should have been emptied a long time ago, and yet we have suffered repeated delays, budget cuts, and of course incompetence on the part of the contractors that are supposedly building the vitrification plant that's to handle these wastes. And what really probably needs to happen here is the public needs to put pressure on their congressional representatives to make sure that there's enough money to take the single wall wastes and put them into double wall tanks. I think if they're not going to get the vitrification plant online soon enough, then they need to move this waste so that we no longer are spilling it into the ground and ultimately into the aquifer and God knows where else.
The Department of Energy is stating that there's no immediate threat. Can you comment on that?
I take a lot of what comes out of the Department of Energy with a huge grain of salt. They're not a reliable source, but, you know, I don't discount that the initial leaks may, in some respect, not be impacting anything immediately where the leaks have gone, but it's moving through the natural life support systems that we all depend on, and ultimately it is going to put itself into the broader environment. What timeline? I don't know. But what we do know, I mean, there's just no doubt about this. These tanks have had problems from the very beginning, and they were supposed to be cleaned up, and this is an effort that should be done, and yet it's not done. And so I really, again, think that it's up to the public to demand greater accountability. And not only that, I think, you know, it would be good to remove the Department of Energy from having control over this and create an independent body that is not so beholden to the nuclear industry in order to get the results that we need.
Senator Wyden's office announced their intent to launch an investigation into the Department of Energy and its contractors. What do you believe will come out of that?
Yeah, I think it's a horror story already. You know, it sounds like what we'll have is yet another report. Whether we ultimately are going to take action on what is really something that we've all been living through over time. I mean, Hanford's been around forever. I mean, we've been dealing with this problem ever since it first became known that we had created this national sacrifice zone. The bottom line is that we need to get some accountability, and we need to get there quick. I hope that Senator Wyden hurries it up and that this just doesn't turn out to be another report, and then other issues are out in front of it, and so it's out of sight, out of mind.
We're hearing reports that the waste is approximately 100 to 150 feet from the water table. What would happen if this waste comes in contact with the groundwater?
Well, it's going to be more widely dispersed, which is what's been happening anyway. And then at that point, depending on the direction of that groundwater, and I suspect it's like a lot of the groundwater at Hanford, it's moving towards the river, then there's yet another body of water that gets into. And then, of course, there's the food chain, and God knows what else that happens here. I mean, one of the horrible realities of nuclear power is that, you know, radiation is the perfect pollutant. You know, you have a hard time determining when you're exposed to it. You can't prove where it came from. And so ultimately the industry gets away with murder.
I've been speaking with Lloyd Marbette, a longtime anti-nuclear activist and the executive director of the Oregon Conservancy Foundation. This is Rebecca Ney with KBOO News.
According to the Natural Resource Defense Council, or NRDC,